Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report someone who I know all of you know. That's Sybil Edmund. She is the founder of Boiling Frogs Post, a wonderful website. If you haven't visited, I'm going to encourage you to do so. She's author of Classified Woman, which tells the story of her role as a FBI translator and then whistleblower and founder of a major whistleblower coalition. And then, as all of us do who try and bring transparency to issues, now she's writing fiction. And she's the published Lone Gladio. And she's joined us today because she has a major news story investigation going on, which, of course, relates to all the different things that she's been a part of. And we want to talk about that, what it means to you, what you can do. So, Sybil, welcome to the Solari Report.
Well, thank you, Catherine. It's great to be with you. And as we just talked about it before the program started, you and I go way, way back.
We do go way back.
Yes, so the beginning of my journey, which started in 2002, and it's amazing to see that 13 years have, you know, have passed and where we are today compared to where we were then. And, of course, there are some optimistic, positive things there, but also there are things that are a little bit disheartening. So we'll go through all that with you.
Well, but who would you have ever thought once upon a time, because I know you have a very, also very impressive academic credentials, that you would be the proprietor of a major media effort?
Well, we are on our way, hopefully, to become a major alternative media, alternative to both the mainstream, but also what we have coined as pseudo-alternatives.
Right.
But again, thank you. Thank you. It's no, it's most people, and I understand why they predicted that I would go away like most whistleblowers or activists do, because it is such a difficult journey, and it's so filled with these discouraging obstacles that, unfortunately, people, either as whistleblowers or as dedicated activists, they get into, but that after facing all these discouraging developments and the obstacles, many get burned out. And I know exactly how that feels, because I have had major periods of times that I felt that I really couldn't do it any longer, that it was futile, that it was like I couldn't even make a dent into this ginormous, big system of corruption. And to be able to find the encouragement again and get back on your feet and keep at it, I would say it's rare, because, as I said, it's very easy to get discouraged, to get burned out and say, you know, heck with it, I'm just going to go away, I can't do it any longer. So it was with establishing National Security Whistleblowers Coalition with 150-plus whistleblowers from all these law enforcement and intelligence agencies and the Department of Defense, and from there graduating into setting up our own little media sites to cover these important topics that really no one covers. And even those who maybe cover it, it's unfortunately tainted by either certain agenda or its partisanship. And the fact that we have lasted for 13 years,
well,
you know, this is something scary. This is exactly what
right. The
establishment, what we coin as deep state, they don't want to see. They do set up all these obstacles, for example, for mainstream media to block and not cover, you know, your issues and topics and cases, and by publishing industry not to print, you know, your books, and all sorts of things they do so that they make you go away and say, you know, it's going to be a David versus Goliath kind of a story, and I can't do this. So when they see those of us who keep at it, even after falling down and getting bloody, keeping at it, well, to me, that alone is success. Maybe for some people it's not tangible success to say, oh, well, did you bring down anybody in terms of corruption? Did anybody go to jail, got held accountable for all these thieveries and corruptions and everything we see? No. So you guys haven't accomplished anything. That's one way of looking at it, which I call pessimistic. But I would say just the fact that we are still here and we are still at it, that is success. That is major. And despite the periods of, I would call being down, being pessimistic, then getting up again and dusting yourself and say, I'm going to go at it and I'm not going to quit. That is success and that is positive.
Well, our topic today is what's the action? And one thing I want to come to before, we'll go through the middle and then we'll come out and talk about what people can do, because I think that you had a wonderful interview with some of your colleagues that I put up on the website. And you said, wait a minute, we've got to stop holding just the media and the establishment accountable. We need to hold everybody accountable. And it was a brilliant commentary on what needs to happen culturally. But let's first dive in to your current story. And it's one that is tremendous interest to me, because one of the things I discovered when I first started to do a website was the importance of helping people understand the fact that there is such a thing as a control file, and there's a control file network, and control files and the control file networks are used to control and really manage a large part of what you're calling the deep state, which is, I think, a phenomenal term. And the story that you're covering right now goes right to the heart of this issue. So maybe if you could introduce it.
Sure. I have to go back a little bit, because this story that we are now campaigning on, it actually started in 1999. So when I was working for the FBI as a language specialist and also analyst for the counterintelligence, the FBI had this program that was that had started in 1996. It's a specific program that started during Bill Clinton's administration when he was going through his scandals with Paula Jones, et cetera, Monica Lewinsky. And that was using the FBI's counterintelligence division to gather data / dirt on major elected officials in U.S. Congress, with the purpose of gathering lots of dirt on the Republican side to counter all these talks or the possibilities of impeachment. And that is absolutely it. That was illegal at a time. Things have changed since 9/11, so now they can do all that through NSA. Because at the time, the counterintelligence division operated under FISA laws, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, meaning what we did was, let's say we would wiretap and have live surveillance, et cetera, monitor foreign entities, okay? Some of these or many of these were diplomatic foreign entities, okay? What's going on with the Pakistani, let's say, embassy, and who are their spies, let's say, in the United States or for all these countries, okay, multiple languages. So what they had, the FBI, was the warrants from the court, the FISA court, allowing them to tap into these people's phone lines, fax lines, et cetera, and gather information to see who's spying, who's, who's sabotaging U.S. interests. That was the purpose of it. It was not to use gathered evidence in U.S. in any courts, like criminal courts, because what they do is, let's say if somebody is conducting espionage from the U.S. embassy, then the U.S. State Department goes and says, you know what, we know that Mr. X is doing this and getting this information from, let's say, RAND Corporation, and send him back to Pakistan, neutralize them, And then, of course, they go back and come back 6 months later with another spy. So that's mostly for counter-espionage, counterintelligence division. Well, under Bill Clinton's directive, it was to use these existing wiretap targets and then add to them additional ones and instead gather dirt on all the activities and conversations, et cetera, by elected officials, okay? So, for example, it can be Congressman X, who is on the side getting some money, which is illegal, from a foreign entity, let's say from the government of Pakistan, that is getting him the money through these channels. And not only that, some personal information as well, meaning what are they up to? Are they having sex with little underage girls or underage boys? Who is a closet homosexual? Who is, you know, those kinds of
things. Right.
And what was the purpose for it? It was to control, we are supposed to have this separation of power. Supposedly Congress is its own separate entity, and that White House, the executive branch can't. These are all in theory, and the same thing, the separation between the courts and the executive branch and the legislative branch. So theoretically, it all sounds good. But once you do these operations, and then you use it to go to these congressmen or to a judge and say, if you don't pass this particular legislation that I'm putting forth, or the executive order, or if you go about impeaching me because you're a leader in Congress, then we are going to air out your skeletons, whether it is that you're a pedophile, or that you're a closet gay, or you're a closet, you know, these kinds of information.
Right.
And people would say, well, that we have expected all along, because these were done from the, you know, in a COINTELPRO operation. I mean, this has been going on, yes, to a certain degree, but this was a new directive in 1996 that really souped it up in the
right.
Within the FBI and the Justice Department. And at the time, Louis Freeh, the director of the FBI, was part of this, and Department of Justice's Janet Reno was part of it. So to just go back to give you a little bit idea to the listeners, that the counterintelligence division I work with, I ended up getting exposed to a lot of these illegal activities or immoral activities by U.S. persons. I was not only listening, let's say, to recorded conversation or live conversation on going through documents on some foreign entities, but this operation that I worked for within FBI's counterintelligence unit also included these U.S. persons' targets. So the agents at the bottom who were doing the work, I mean, they were not part of this whole conspiracy. Initially, they were told, and we were all told, that this was done so that we would have enough evidence that we can take some of these people to court. Well, one of the top people that had the thickest files in the FBI, and that included embezzlement, illegal campaign financing operations, and also sexual activities with minor boys, and involvement with certain criminal networks, underground networks. One of the top people that had the thickest file was, at the time, the Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, Republican.
Now, didn't he come in when they got Livingston out? So they got,
exactly.
I thought they got Livingston out over the impeachment, and then they put Hastert in.
Exactly. So what happened
right.
was, if you remember, Catherine, some people went to Larry Flynt and leaked these taped conversations between Bob Livingston with some escort ladies and hookers, and he was having raunchy phone sex with them. And then Larry Flynt and those people, they called Bob Livingston 2 days before the impeachment, and they said, impeachment hearings, and they said, we are going to publicize this. So Bob Livingston, at the time the Speaker of the House, Republican, heading this impeachment against, Clinton, ended up resigning 2 days before the impeachment hearings. Well, who do you think gave those taped documents to Larry Flynt? It was not somebody going and tapping Bob Livingston's phones in his house or in his office. These were all gathered intelligence by the U.S. Department of Justice under Janet Reno and the FBI's Washington field office. So that was basically putting it, you know, to work, what Clinton administration had FBI
right.
doing. And they had several other Republicans, if you remember, right around that whole impeachment hearing time that were outed. that they were having affairs. One of them had a son, illegitimate child, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they had all this stuff and even more on Dennis Hastert, but Dennis Hastert told them that he would play ball. He would basically do what they wanted, basically, the executive branch. So Dennis Hastert became the Speaker of the House in 1999, despite having the thickest criminal files. I would say criminal because it was filled with criminal deeds in addition to other what people consider like really immoral or disgusting, unethical operations and conduct. He was engaged in a bunch of illegal activities directly.
Right.
So
I just wanted to tell you one thing. During the first Bush administration in 1989, I was working as Assistant Secretary of Housing, and I experienced the secretary being blackmailed. And I have always believed it was in connection with the Franklin cover-up that was going on at the same time. The headlines were coming out in the Washington Times. And it's interesting when you see a person I've never seen a human being more afraid than watching him during that period. It was almost, you know, the fear was, I've seen people facing death, and he was more afraid than that. And, you know, reality was he was going to do whatever he was told. He was going to, because otherwise he's looking at losing not only his career, his family, his friend, everything. You know, you lose your entire life if those files are ever made public.
And there
so
is
it's,
no
it's
other
very powerful
of
stuff.
Control that is more powerful.
Yeah.
You're right. That's the most powerful control mechanism that you can have
in the
political world. And I'm glad you mentioned it because Congress was, of course, one of the main targets, people in Congress, but there were people within the State Department, there were people from within the DOD. Let's say in the State Department, one of the people they have gathered criminal files, including espionage activities, was Mark Grossman under Clinton, who ended up being promoted as soon as Bush came to office, and he was made the number three man in the State Department. And the FBI already had enough on this man that they could have put him in jail for just on espionage charges alone. So all these things happened, and then my whistleblowing took place. I was fired, and I was not in the FBI for a long time. But what made my case unusual, I would say, I guess that would be an understatement, would be, you see, I was not a spy. I was not an operative, CIA operative, yet they ended up invoking state secrets privilege and gagging my case in court and in Congress twice. And in fact, when the government went to court in 2002, they told the judge that even where I was born, where I went to school, you remember all this, Catherine, they're all classified.
Of course.
I mean, my birth date, they classified it. They say even her birth date is classified.
One of my favorite parts in your book is when you describe the fact that you're not allowed to tell anybody what your birthday is or you violate the law.
Think about it. I mean, Catherine, let's say I'm speeding, and it was so ludicrous. I said, we told the judge. The police pulls me over and says, okay, your driver's license. And I'm saying, I'm sorry, officer, I can't show it to you because it's classified document. My birthday is listed in there. It was so Kafkaesque. It was so outrageous. But they succeeded. The judge agreed with them. They said everything about this woman is classified. And the ACLU later took my case, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, et cetera. But I became known as the most gagged, most classified woman in the history of this country. Nobody has had two invocations of state secrets privilege. On top of that, the Justice Department went to Congress, and they put a gag order on Congress on my case. They said you can't have any hearings, you can't give media any statement on Sybil Edmonds' case, which is constitutionally illegal. You can't have executive
I didn't know that you could. Until I read your book, I didn't know you could gag Congress.
Well, because you can. You couldn't. They
you can.
Couldn't.
How can the executive branch?
Guess what, Catherine? The reason the Congress abided by it, this is even Senator Grassley, Senator Leahy, they went and destroyed all the files that they were putting together to have a hearing on my case. Well, they used that blackmail so that the congressional leaders who were in this case would abide by their illegal, unconstitutional order. It was under retroactive classification. So anyhow, they gagged the Congress, even though it was unconstitutional, illegal. Congress didn't challenge. They said, you know, sure, masters, we will do whatever you say. And so this case was going through the court with the Supreme Court and the ACLU, and all these things were happening. In 2005, Vanity Fair magazine, they are mainstream, but somehow they found this one investigative journalist, this British guy, David Rose, and they decided to do a story on my case. And for this story, this is Vanity Fair and I, through all the whistleblowers I knew and the people they knew, we were able to put together five other people. Some of them were at the time still working at the Department of Justice in the FBI, and have all of us give this reporter information that said the Speaker of the House at the time, Dennis Hastert, was still the Speaker of the House. This is 2005, Catherine. So they ran the 7-page expose, and about 2 pages of it was on Dennis Hastert receiving farm bribery, being involved in the illegal drug networks in Chicago, personally, directly, and all sorts of information implicating Dennis Hastert. And it was confirmed. They had to triple check the story. You know, the publications have to have fact checkers. So after they interview you, the reporters, the fact checkers calls and double, make sure, go through it once or twice to make sure that the statement the reporter gave is accurate, that you stand by your statement. Because they were afraid Dennis Hastert would come and sue them or the Justice Department, Vanity Fair, they did triple fact-checking. Instead of one layer, they did it 3 times to make sure that their story was solid, their legal department got involved, because it is the sitting Speaker of the House. The story came out, and this is the sitting Speaker of the House. Do you know what happened?
Probably nothing.
Not a single publication in the United States, that's New York Times, Washington Post, even local publications in Illinois, let's say Chicago Tribune, nobody touched it. There was this complete hush. And you would think it's being this Republican guy, the Democrats would be like up in arm and screaming and making a scandal out of this, because it was a scandal, right?
Mm-hmm.
That front was completely quiet as well, because one of the things that we told Vanity Fair was Dennis Hastert was one of them, but this whole counterintelligence operation had dirts and criminals like Hastert, and the worst ones, 8 of them were Republican, 4 were Democrats.
Right.
So it was nonpartisan, it was bipartisan corruption criminal gang. In addition to that, the illegal order to the FBI DOJ to do this originated from the Democrat Bill Clinton's administration, right? So then you have both sides of the aisles not wanting anyone to touch this. But the most amazing part for me at the time, I was more naive, I mean, I was so much naiver, was the fact that nobody touches in the media. It was nothing. I mean, you would see it on, you know, CNN or Fox. You would think Speaker of the House that is sitting is there. He's the number 3 guy for presidency. Something happens to the president, it's the vice president. And if something happens to the vice president, who do you get? Which we have had a case like that during Kennedy. So nothing.
Can I tell you one story? Just to affirm what you're saying, I was working with an investigative reporter in Washington on the story of the defense contractor who had been twice, had litigation against them because they were sex slave trafficking in Europe, Eastern Europe. And this was very documented, including by the Army Criminal Investigation Division. And it wasn't just people on the contract. It was the government technical representative, so it was the person running the contract, and it was clearly a systemic, you know, this was I believe part of their business. And and she wrote a fabulous story. It was cover story, Insight magazine, nailed the whole thing, you know, hard evidence. And Insight magazine was delivered to every congressional office, both the House and Senate. And I made sure to email it to every contract office, particularly in the IT contracts, for every agency where this company had business. And the next week after the story came out, the Navy and the State Department awarded them huge new contracts. And then when the Iraq War started, they got a $500 million sole source contract to run. Are you ready for this? Police, courts, and enforcement in Iraq. And it was very interesting. One of the guys at the State Department wrote a letter to Congress and said, a company shouldn't be held responsible for behavior of an errant employee, which clearly, if you knew the story, it was systemic. It wasn't just one person. And, you know, and so we're talking about a very significant problem here that relates to the safety of children, not just here, but all over the world.
And and that's exactly what happened. All this hushing happened and nothing came out of it. Supreme Court, they sided with the government and they said, if the government, FBI, DOJ, says everything is classified, who are we, Supreme Court judges, to disagree with them while we are facing the terror threat, et cetera? These were the Supreme Court judges. Look at the independence, the separation. If they say it, who are we to disagree with them when our nation is facing terror threat? They are saying, if this woman's birth date comes out, they're going to be attacked by terrorists. I mean, so this was, you know, how during the beginning of this show, I talked about the down period. You know, I was so discouraged. I was so disgusted. I was so beaten, saying, I blew the whistle. I went to Congress. They went and they gagged the Congress. I went to court. They went and stopped the court. I went to the media. And the media, even when they did something, nothing comes out of it. It's like, what else can I do? And this was during my down period, which lasted close to about a year and a half. And I packed my stuff and I went, and actually I moved to Vietnam. I lived there for a year and I became mother in Vietnam. I adopted my daughter. She was 1 week old and I was away from all these things for about a year and a half. It was that disgust period saying, I don't want to deal with any of these things. I've done more than enough. I've done my share. It doesn't make a difference. It's blowing in the wind. Maybe playing Peter, Paul, Mary songs over and over again. So that was my down period, but some great stuff happened, and motherhood included during that period. Then I came back in 2008, and I went to that re-energized period, and I said, you know what? I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to write a book. And I did, and I spent 2.5 years.
The book is beautifully written. It's a great read. It's really good.
Thank you. I mean, that coming from you, that means a lot, Catherine.
I just have to tell you one thing. I used to always think, she must have the world's greatest husband. And then I read the book and I said, she does. She has the world's greatest husband.
I do. We've been married for 24 years. We just celebrated our 24th year in October, October 18th. And he stood by me. It's unfortunate. Many whistleblowers I know, they ended up not having their spouses' support because, you know, some of them were the sole breadwinners for their family. So their spouses are like, if you do this, it's going to ruin our life and our financial situation, et cetera. And that makes it triple hard. And it was so sad and hard to see that they were fighting several fronted battles, not only the, you know, the corrupt deep state system and the courts, et cetera, but also in their home life they were suffering.
Right.
And I was fortunate. I was fortunate because my partner, my husband, he stood by me. Even when things got so nasty, so ugly, so difficult, and of course the down periods that I had, and he did, and I am fortunate. I'm very thankful to be fortunate to have a husband who has been so very supportive in this. I wrote the book, I finished it, and so here it is. I work for the FBI, and when you start working, you sign away your life. I didn't even know at the time, because I obtained the top secret clearance, okay? So that I had access to the most classified, highest level classified documents recording. Well, when you get the clearance background check and the clearance is granted, you sign when you work with the FBI, for the FBI, even as a contractor, there is that clause that says, if you ever publish a nonfiction book, okay, and has anything to do, even one word, about the work you did and your title with the FBI, before you submit your work to the publisher, before it goes through editing and formatting and anybody sees it, before you even give it to your agent, you have to, and this is true for anybody who works for intelligence agencies, FBI, CIA, DIA, all people have to sign this. And I did too at the time when I got the job with the FBI. I have to submit this manuscript in this box to the FBI, DOJs, they call the department the pre-publication review, right? So they have, by law, this is the FBI or the CIA's pre-pub review, 1 month, 30 business days to go through your manuscript, comb through anything that may be classified, maybe some FBI current target that you ended up putting the name there that would threaten national security or an ongoing case. So what they do is they go through this, they have a black marker, and they black out anything that they deem classified. And at the end of that 30 business days, they send it back to you. You take out all that blacked out section. Then you go and give your work to the publishers to say, okay, and then you see which one is going to accept publishing it. Then it goes through editorial process. So that's the process. So I did, because I was obligated, this was a nonfiction classified woman, I sent this book. And through my attorneys people who used to represent me when I had court cases, by this time I don't even have a court case, right? So we send it in a box. In fact, they included my attorneys a black marker too. It's like, here it is. Go ahead, black out whatever you think is classified. And if you don't have a pen here, we give you one. And then at the end of 30 days, we expect to get this box back. So we send it to them. 30 days came, nothing. 60 days, so my attorneys started sending letters. By law, you had 30 days. After about 3 months of not responding to us, they sent us a letter and they said, reconsider every single word in this document, in this manuscript, classified. That includes the title, classified woman, Sibel Edmonds' name, like chapter one is there's two words, right? Because that's what their letter said. Every single word in the manuscript you submitted to us, we consider classified. It's blacked out. So you can't publish a single word. You can't even say the, like classified, nothing. My attorneys, they said, this is baloney, and this is unconstitutional. And so that went for another 6 months. And they ended up sending it threatening letters saying, if she publishes this, any word of this, she's going to be criminally liable, okay? And they don't have a single ground for that because, anyhow, my attorneys at this point, they came and they said, well, you have two options. You take a chance, go publish. They're going to come and put you in jail, and you know how they have all the judges. They can get away with it. Or just throw it out. They are not letting you publish this. I said, I was very, very cautious. I did not put anything that justifiably would damage any ongoing investigation, FBI, or some terrorist-related information. I said, I'm going to publish it. And then we go to court and fight. Let the American public see. I mean, Fahrenheit 451. I mean, this is even worse, right? So I took this manuscript, and I went to publishers. And I went to, let's say, 5 to 10 publishers, large ones and mid-sized ones. They all said, if you don't show us the pre-pub review clearance, and if the FBI doesn't say it's okay, we will not publish it because we don't want to end up in some kind of legal battle. We don't want to do all the work, and the FBI comes and takes away all this, you know, all the books from the shelf, etc. Nobody was willing to publish my book. So at this point, you say, well, it's not going to happen, right? I didn't. We went and we got a second loan on our house. So we put together something. I think it was $12,000. And I went and I hired my own team of a seasoned editor who used to be editor for one of these top publishers for 30 years. He was retired. And I got a cover designer. I got a proofreader, the interior formatting person, and I self-published it. I self-published it, and it did quite well, but it was for the first few months, it was like we were sitting and waiting to be arrested. They didn't do anything. Nothing. And this was
well, the problem is if they had done anything, the sales would have skyrocketed.
That's true, while I was sitting maybe in jail, but it was one of those lost things with the FBI and with the government, and they engage in this a lot. And they know
right.
that 99% of the people would blink and say, okay, I just don't want to go to jail. I don't want to take a chance, even if it's 1%. 2012, the book came out, nothing happened. Okay. But as I was doing all this, I said, you know what I'm going to do? This whole thing that I have to send pre-pub for review, et cetera, only applies for nonfiction articles and books. I'm going to write a fiction book, which is going to be part two of my I'm going to write a fiction book that's going to be part two of my nonfiction book. I'm going to be able to express all the things that I could not say in this book. And I'm going to put so much in there that's going to be much far more real and scarier than the truth.
Right.
Which, as soon as the book came out a few months later, I sat down and I started writing the second book, the fiction book, The Lone Gladio. And the reason I'm bringing this up is not to publicize my book here. It is because my second book has tons of information on Dennis Hassert, and it explains that my fiction book, how it's done, from the blackmailing, et cetera. And then you mentioned, Catherine, the international aspects of it, that it threatens the world, kids, and that's very true. And if
yeah.
you look at the second chapter in this, the Speaker of the House actually happens to be the whip in this fiction book. The House Whip, and and it takes place, the first scene in Chapter 2, it takes place in Cambodia. And these congressional people, including Dennis Hastert, you know, when they went for congressional junkets, for example, to Turkey, to Morocco, to Vietnam, in one case, for example, there, and somebody actually documented this, they had an arrangement, and these are these congressional State Department people, with the director of this orphanage in Southeast Asia, that in the evening after that 9, 10 o'clock p.m., they would put these little kids, 6, 7 years old, virgin, because they are afraid, these pedophiles, that they're going to get AIDS and all sorts of diseases if they were to go to pros, and the ones who are in the street, 12, 13 years old. And the director, who happens to be a woman, would deliver these fresh, virgin kids, children, to this five-star hotel where, you know, U.S. representatives, some of them, and some State Department people would basically rape these kids and have sex with them, and some of them even photograph them. So it's real. It's not fiction. It's not conspiracy. And while all these things are happening overseas, all of these activities are monitored and recorded by the CIA as well, because they do the overseas part of it.
Right.
So, and that is documented in my fiction book, which came out in 2014. Now,
you know, and I hate to add this, but this is what people around the world think of us.
Why?
This is what they know about us.
You know, during my campaign on Dennis Hassert, which is still ongoing, I was basically shouting, I was saying, all those groups and the NGOs who go repeatedly and went repeatedly to Congress and with their petition on stopping child trafficking and sexual abuse children, how many of them sat with Dennis Hastert? You know, imagine for these cases that you want to put a stop to as activists and grassroots and NGOs, you are going to the people who are doing it. Okay, which
right.
became public in Dennis Hassert case in 2015, and this is a year after my fiction. This is 3 years after my book. This is 10 years since Vanity Fair article was published. We were on our way to leave the country. We were going to be away for 2 months for my coming book, Research. So it's May 28th. I'm in LAX in the airport. I'm about to board a plane, and I get these beeping on my iPhone, and I see the headlines, Dennis Hastert is being indicted and charged with these financial fraud because he gave $3.5 million cash as hush money to one or two of the boys that he was raping and sexually abusing when he was a high school coach in 1970s and 1980s. And my reaction at that point was like, 10 years since Vanity Fair, and we gave all this information. You know, it was all included. Now, their legal department could not go far enough without documents to talk about the sexual cases, but they mentioned his illegal criminal activities. And years after my first book and a year and a half since my second book, and finally this guy is being charged. He's caught on financial things, which already is out the fact that the reason he was withdrawing this amount every month and lying about it to the government was because he was giving $3.5 million hush money to the boy or boys he was raping and abusing, the pedophile, in a school as a teacher, okay? But the way U.S. mainstream media and alternatives went about treating this case was nobody ever brought up the case that in 2005, Dennis Hastert, as a Speaker of the House, was exposed in 7-page expose. Not one mention. Even if you go to Dennis Hastert's Wikipedia entry, it's listed there.
So let me bring up my concern about what's going on, because the question is, why now? You know, why all of a sudden are they doing this now? And I have to tell you that if you were to make a list of every Republican who has indictable evidence against the Clintons, you know, they're dropping like flies right now.
Yep.
And my concern is coming into a Clinton election, the Clintons are, you know, they're basically taking out anybody who could give them any trouble, Dennis Hastert included. So the reason they're going after this guy right now is not because they're trying to bring justice to the world.
And hold them accountable. Absolutely. You are seeing the
right
play of 1999. During
administrations
and impeachment, that's exactly what's the case. But the part is, even Republicans have been really quiet about it, which is amazing because we have been exposing this since Hastert's story broke. But they didn't mention, they are not mentioning the fact that the expose was there on Vanity Fair in 2005. They are not exposing the fact that he was listed in two books. They are not mentioning my under oath testimony in 2010 in Krikorian case. I was deposed and under oath. I had to tell them about Dennis Hastert, including his sexual activities in one of his townhouses. And all of those were arranged and organized and coordinated by his chief of staff, Scott Palmer. Nobody's even talking about Scott Palmer. And to this day,
well, but here's what I'm seeing is, you know, traditionally, if you played ball, you know, nobody went after you. And I think what we're seeing in Washington, for a variety of reasons, is people who've been playing ball are suddenly getting targeted. So Hastert is a guy who's played ball his whole life, but that isn't good enough anymore. Suddenly he's having done to him what Livingston had done to him. You know, live by the sword, die by the sword.
Off others. If you don't get in line, you're gonna be hazardized, you know?
Right. I think people are scared to death because they don't know, you know, playing ball isn't good enough. I just think there's real fear.
Well, that basically summarizes why we started this campaign. And this was, now they have a plea deal, and you know what he got? 0 to 6 months with emphasis on zero for all his criminal deeds.
It's unbelievable.
Because Hastert also had plenty of gray mail to use against the government, because Hastert knows, and I'm sure during the plea bargain behind the closed doors, like, you do this, we want you to put out all those things you collected on me during, you know, per Clinton administration's order, which was illegal under FISA. So everybody had reason to work out this. He's not going to see a single day in jail. That's it. Finished. But we did the campaign, and that also became a catalyst, another awakening moment to say, you know, we have done this great news website, but with limited resources, three, four of us, and it's time to go to phase two of this, and we can't go and say, try to push media to cover it. Why not become a major media source without being dependent on those who are obscuring the facts? Because in our current climate, out in the on the net, when you're looking at the media landscape, Catherine, you see four categories, okay? One, you see the same as the establishment media, the billionaires and investors on advertising model, you know, Salon.com. You're looking at Pierre Omidyar, the billionaire PayPal. He's setting up Intercept with his billions of dollars. You're looking Amazon's owner is setting up his thing, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one category. There's no difference between those and New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera. The second category is what I call the establishment foundations. Okay, so even though foundations, they're NGOs, you're looking at the same corporate billionaires. George Soros, Catherine, gives millions of dollars to each one of these online publications. Now, you tell me, why would a dirty billionaire like George Soros give $4 million to ProPublica? I'm just throwing the numbers, $1.5 million to this and $5 million to this. Is it because they want to expose the deep state? They want to mobilize and have real, meaningful changes? No.
I have to tell you, I started publishing articles on, it was right after 9/11, on narcotics trafficking and the laundering by the major financial institutions and the involvement with government and the financial system. And within short order, I found myself being attacked by all these war on drugs activists. Just attack, 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 attack. And finally, I couldn't figure it out. Finally, Al Giordano at Narco News sent me a copy of an email received. They were all basically saying that they thought I was going to try and take their Soros funding away from them. I wrote them an email and I said, I can't afford to have Soros money. That would destroy my credibility. Are you kidding? But what I realized is they were all
I wouldn't be having this session with you, Catherine. In fact, I do not have any connections, any communications with people, even those people who were, for partisan reason, on my camp during the early stage, 2003, 2004. They washed their hands off me, and I don't want to deal with them because there is a reason that Rockefeller Foundation is supporting them. There is a reason.
Right.
If people were to consider Rockefeller and Soros and Omidyar, these people, as wonderful, angelic people with the best interests of the public in mind, go ahead and say hooray. Otherwise, anybody with any capability in critical thinking department would say no. So there's establishment directly by corporations. Second category is foundations, which are the same billionaire corporations. Then you have the entertainers. I don't know how else to coin them. You know, they are those people, maybe Rush Limbaugh, et cetera. Maybe they are the showman. I don't know.
Right.
They are the ones, that's its own. People who want entertainment and they want to scream and things, they can go there. The fourth category, we have thousands of people. You know, your site, my site, James Corbett's site, Yair Mohamed. I mean, some of them do great work,
yeah.
But they are limited by their resources and their reach and visibility. Most of them have to maintain daytime job, work full time to bring and pay the rent and eat, have something to eat, you know, to have clothes to put on themselves. So that means they are doing it with whatever they have, limited resources, outside their work hours. And even though they are capable of producing some great work and bringing great clarity to many of these issues, it's just they have that limit. So this is why I'm starting this new media project by bringing some of these select top truly independent alternatives, meaning A, nonpartisan. It's not that I'm going to get on Democrats, I'm going to get the Republicans, I'm going to get the Libertarians. It's not that,
right.
Okay? Number two, they don't have any ties or connection to any foundations. I don't care whether they are Koch brothers or they are Rockefellers, no foundation. I don't want
right.
any advertisements on my site.
Right.
I don't
right.
want to have the pictures of vaginas and penises because I'm seeing these mega media organizations,
yeah.
Catherine. I just went to one that they have 200 million visitors and they got close to $500 million in funding, BuzzFeed. And my husband was next to me. We came to the site and there was this lady's butt and then there was another lady's boobs. So it was like boobs, boobs, butts. It's just like there is no news. It's all about nudity and entertainment. I mean, I don't even know why that would be entertaining. I mean, how much can you look at boobs? You know, I mean, there's a limit. After a while, it has to cease
right.
being entertaining. But again, I guess that's a different mindset. So to say we don't have those kinds of things. So we have the first year 10 alternatives coming together. And get the resources that will give us a good IT department, because today you need those web administration and the IT skills. I mean, there's so much you can do by yourself.
Right.
And then to have
right.
a seasoned news editor who's done this as an alternative. And I've already found two who want to come on board. 3-4 investigative journalists, bringing great video producers, podcast producers, who do shows like yours, like what you're doing, and what
right.
we have been doing at BFB, and then have like hourly updated content, so it's not like boring, okay, once a week they have something. Have our own select news, developments that the media doesn't cover, the weather pseudo-alternatives. Basically, you're looking at an organization with 15 full-time people working overtime, with
right.
IT resources and everything to say that's what we do. Because now I'm going to go back quickly to what you brought up about the conversation we had. You know, during the initial stage of my whistleblowing when you met me, 2002, 2003, first I went to Congress, right, and I reported it because I thought that was the appropriate channel, the naive me. And of course, that was shut down. Then I was pointing finger and say, if Congress did what they are supposed to do, what they took their oath to do, we wouldn't be in this shape. Then I dealt with the courts, including the Supreme Court, and the same blackmail applies to the federal judges, big time. Then I pointed out, said, if the courts are not doing what they are obligated to do, they are not serving the interests of the American people. Then it was the media, and for years, that's why I started boiling Fox News and say, if the media truly reported instead of censuring, blacking out, actually playing the game for them, being the tentacle of this deep, corrupt, deep state, we wouldn't be in this position. But one thing I realized at the end of this long journey to where I am today is, you know, we can point finger and say, they should do their jobs. They are not doing, whether it's Congress, whether it's the media. But really, when it gets down to it, there are people who even get this information and they have become apathetic, they have become desensitized,
right.
or they are so lazy. Or some people have...
Afraid. Many people are afraid.
Afraid. And we also look at
right.
moral clarity, and we are also looking at the issues of moral strength, which today it's like a cuss word. If you're on some shows, video or podcast or radio, and you start using words like decency, human decency, I mean, people would laugh. They would say, what an old-fashioned, disgusting thing to say. You're not progressive if you use words like decency, you know?
Right.
So it is people, and I think we have to, instead of pointing fingers saying why they are not doing it, instead, what can we do? What can little me can do here? However little it is, collectively it can become big. So it's time to stop pointing fingers and say, it is what it is. They are corrupt. They are criminal. Yes, there is deep state. We are not talking about some conspiracy that is far-fetched. It's the reality of it. It's a documented reality. And history
right.
basically illustrates it right before your eyes, is to say, what can I do? How can I mobilize? How can I do things? Even if I have full-time job, even if I have half an hour, what is my responsibility? And that is what we would like to see start and begin. And And I've been waiting for it to happen, and I'm not going to wait. I'm going to do my part to make it happen with this new media project.
Right. And I think the first thing we can do is do everything we can to protect our kids and to make sure kids are safe. Because if you don't make sure the kids are safe and well-educated, then you're not going to have a society.
That's absolutely true, because so much of the brainwashing, so much of it happens there in the school, and they are making it worse with Common Core. And this is why before we started recording, I was asking you, and I mentioned the fact that with this site, we are going to have coverage because we can afford in terms of time and resources anything that in this area, which is extremely important to me. My daughter is 7 years old, on Common Core and what's happening with school and how the local communities have been neutered and everything is being dictated from up their federal government. And then the federal government is bought out by all this software company, by all these billionaires. It is now creating another private industry that is trillions of dollars worth. People who gotta be putting these softwares, people, now they have become these consumers of billionaires. And that is
right. And one of the reasons it was so important to me to have you on the Solaire Report is to give the background on why I say Common Core is not safe. In other words, you know, allowing big corporations and the intelligence agencies to have online access to your kids, particularly where there's not appropriate supervision, it's not okay. They're not, you know, you're dealing with, you know, organizations that have traditionally been deeply involved with pedophilia.
Absolutely. I'm fighting it every step of the way. Second day of her first day in school, she comes, my daughter, with this form to sign up for this Dojo application. It's Dojo rewarding monster, Dojo monster system. So instead of giving kids little stars, you know, when you do something good, they do it online through this company, connected to the internet, in the classroom live. You did the bad things, you're going to lose one Dojo monster, okay? So in order to do that, we were supposed to go online, apply for this, put our email address, all the information, and they're going to track everything my child does, whether she gets disciplined or whether she gets rewarded. So we send a letter to her teacher. We said, absolutely, we are opting out. I know that, you know, this is the third grade is when they roll out Common Core, which we're going to do.
Right.
Plus, we are with the community opposing it. But even with these applications, one by one, the unfortunate thing, Catherine, is her classroom has 22 students. We were the only parents who are opting out. We are the only parents who are opting out from these online stuff. I go to pick up my kids, and I'm talking to these mothers. They are saying, oh, what you got to do today? You have to do that. There is no way around it. So they have their kids vulnerable. All their information is going into these databases. They're going to get sold. When you go and read the footnotes of these application and internet program providers, they actually say, oh, we may not sell it to advertisers, but we maintain the right to share it with other partner companies. And
right.
But she gets to be, in a way, marginalized already, because then the teacher said, well, how are we going to deal with this? Because I don't want her to feel left out. All the other kids, they dress up their online Dojo monsters and collect Dojo monsters, and she's going to be left out. I said, we're going to explain to a seven-year-old as much as we can, and we did. And then would you please give her something like a star as incentive? And she was at least nice enough to accept it. But it's a battle. And the fact that we need to wake up these parents, because they're standing there looking at me with these absent eyes, and they're saying, well, what's wrong with it? And
see, most people cannot fathom that what is happening is really happening. They
well,
just
it is
cannot
happening.
Fathom.
It
yeah.
is happening. It is happening.
Right.
I mean, come on, look at some of the parents. They don't have private Facebook. They have regular Facebook. They're putting their little 3-4 years old naked pictures of their kids in the bathtub, thinking it's nice and cute. Well, I tell you what, do you have any idea how many pedophiles are jerking off looking at your kids' pictures? I mean, common sense, Catherine. I mean, have we lost our common sense? Things are that commonsensical. For me, it's mind-boggling. So, yes, we need to educate the community.
It's a whole other topic, but one of my favorite Solaire reports is an interview I did with Adam Trombley on entrainment technology. And in, I think it was in 2010, 2011, I was running into so many problems with people with entrainment tricking them on in their financial lives. That I just said, Adam, look, you've got to come on the Solari Report and explain to people that this technology exists and it's being used to manipulate you. And I, frankly, I think the whole smartphone media, you know, the whole digital media infrastructure, there is an enormous amount of entrainment. I just got back from Europe and I feel like I'm walking back into, you know, mind control USA.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it's, I mean, even when they do the success story comparisons, like they're showing the Scandinavian model of education. For example, they start at 7, they don't start at 5, 6. And they are not dependent upon all these internet technological things. And then you look at the ranking of both mentally being successful, happy, mentally healthy kids, okay? I mean, they're,
right.
You know, don't even start me on all these people who are giving pills to their kids because they are a little bit too active.
Right.
And if you're a little too active, you're definitely, you have ADHD. But I really would love to have this as part of our, because my husband and I, we talk about it all the time. I am fighting it every step of the way because my child is so important. She's my life, okay? And it's worth the fight. And even though I'm the only parent in this one particular classroom, but it's going to come maybe to a point where we are going to homeschool. Because we are already preparing and we have put the folders. Now, I want her to be socialized. I want her to be around kids. I want her to have what I had because I had pretty decent, it was not perfect, education life during my elementary years and then the the middle school, high school. But she's not going to be the collateral damage. Let me put it this way.
Right.
If they put in the system, let's say 10 years from now, they're going to come and put all these publications, how much damage it did Common Core, and it didn't give what they are saying people is going to bring us and we're going to be...
Well, I'll tell you one of my dreams. My dreams is two things happen. Everybody say, you know, we're not doing this. They pull their kids out. But at the same time they pull their kids out, they walk into court and say, we want all of our property taxes escrowed instead of going to the common school.
This is the movement. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
Right. We're going to, you and I, the next conversation we have is, okay, how do we start to re-engineer the taxes? Because we can't pay for something that's harming us.
Thank you. Because I told my husband, I said, you know, right now they don't care. I'll pull out. I'm going to homeschool. That's basically, in some way, is copping out. We need to change it because, I mean, look at this.
Well, but beware what where they want to go is they want to go to vouchers, but the vouchers will come attached to a requirement to do Common Core.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
even now, private schools who are not obligated, there are two private schools in our district. Both of them are going to voluntarily plug in Common Core, which is just so ridiculous. But let me put it this as an analogy, and I know we got to go, but we have become a society where we privatize our prisons and we are making profit out of crime. What does it say about our moral state as a society? And that we are saying it's okay. Have these private prisons and people, judges, get motivated by putting people behind bars, and the more people we put behind bars, the more profit goes to them. That is goes hand in hand with what is happening, what we are seeing with the schools. They have become these consumers and the field market for these billionaires. And it's just mind-boggling, and this is why I really would love to have all your activism, which is related to what I feel passionate about, also part of this new media project that we are planning to launch. Our Kickstarter is going to begin first week in February. And it's going to be
okay, let us know. Let me know and I'll post it.
I certainly will. I will.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much for
Well, you're amazing. And I can't thank you enough for
hours.
Yes, we could. You and I could really get going, but that's what we hit. The next conversation we have to have is how do we re-engineer the money? Because we're going to have to shift the money because then, you know, so many people are financially dependent on the federal budget. So you got to shift the money. And in fact, if you shift the money, you can save taxpayers a whole lot of money and kickstart the economy. So there's a lot of opportunity in it. Anyway, okay, Ms. Edmonds, you're fabulous. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.